Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday to you. Hope you're doing well. This is Cliff out here in parched California. I have to remind people about that because most of you think California is this place of milk and honey, and we are dealing with a serious drought, boy, I'll tell you. I was reading an article the other day on the golf courses, and golf courses need just tons of water. The greens, the fairways, the surrounding bushes and trees and everything. And there are specialists that are out there now, and these specialists are known for replacing the greens, the fairways, with plants that don't need a lot of water. And so this article went on to say that great sections of the main fairways were being removed in and replaced with these bush plants that grow quickly without a lot of water. And the look of golf courses, and in California, there's hundreds of golf courses because the weather is always nice for the most part. And from Northern California all the way down to San Diego, you know, there's every major city or every city has their two or three municipal golf courses, but then there's the private golf courses. And there was a time where if you were, you would pay for it, but it's so bad that it's like I was looking at one of these photographs. The fairways are like straight landing strips, and then there's the greens and then the putting greens and then the tee off areas. But I'll tell you, this is serious, and I'm encouraging everybody who's out here to really be thoughtful about your water usage, because although they're spending a couple of billion on a desalination plant in Santa Barbara, I think there's one in San Diego that's going in, and I think I was reading that there's another one that's being planned for Los Angeles, and they're $1 billion each. But desalination means they pump the salt water, the ocean water, up. They do a number of filters. They deionize it, which means they heat it up, and then the evaporated water is funneled down, and that's what the drinking water is. The process is very expensive, but that's what we have to use. And I mentioned this before, we have a huge agricultural business that sucks 80% of the water. They are beginning to struggle. So I don't know what the future holds. If we continue to have longstanding issues around water, then I don't know if we're going to be the breadbasket for the country anymore. I think we're probably going to have to reconsider our water use. Anyhow, other than that, it's a nice day. Oh, boy. If you had a chance to look at our Facebook page, you know, we have recently posted some photographs on the Cydonia region, and I call it the face number two. A lot of people have been questioning me about the post of this because the satellite from the European Space Agency took some much clearer photographs of the Cydonia region. And the face two is not close to the main face on Mars, Cydonia face. It's a few hundred miles away. But these photographs obviously are held. And face two, many people are, and they're telling me this looks like just a round image with some features that could be an eyes, may have one time been a nose and then a mouth. Well, what I have been reminded of by Dr. John Brandenburg is that these ruins are 250 million years old. And that's just a mind-boggling number. And when you take that into consideration and you look at these features, you begin to get a sense of, you know, that these were monuments. And if you read John's book, he actually shows that the top of the head is a helmet. And the only way that I can discern this face two from any other mountain or hill are these features around the top of the head, the side mounts, some decorations and things like that. So I really encourage you to take a look at the features on the on this photograph that I posted. It's on Facebook, Earth Ancients. Take a look at it. I'm going to post it again, and you'll see the details. Now, there's also some other unique areas. We had George Haas, part of the Cydonia Institute, the Society for Planetary SETI Research, and George has recently submitted another paper to the Journal of Space Exploration on a unique image. He calls it the crown face, and I have George on with us right now. Hi, George.
Hey, Cliff. Great to be on your show, and thanks for having me back on.
Yeah, yeah. I'm curious about this crown face. Now, I've seen photos of it, but you actually have submitted a quite detailed scientific paper, which I took a look at. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this crown face, the importance of it, and why you felt significant enough to come up with this quite detailed analysis of the object?
Yeah. Well, this feature called the crown face was actually discovered 15 years ago, back in the year 2000, in the summer of 2000, when the Mars Global Surveyor released this image. And a member of the Society for Planetary SETI Research, Greg Orm, he had discovered it and brought it to the attention of the Society for Planetary SETI Research, which Dr. Brandenburg is a member of. He's one of the founding members. And also Dr. Tom Van Franlin, who's was a member at the time, unfortunately has passed away a few years ago. He was very instrumental in trying to get this formation, get the attention of NASA and the scientific community. He actually had a press conference of the following year in 2001 in New York. The New York press conference, he featured a lot of anomalous facial features and pictographic images that people were finding at the time. And one of the focal points was this crown face that he had up there. And Tom Van Franlin thought this formation had the most striking richness of detail. And he was very impressed by it. And what the formation is, it's not like Mount Rushmore or like the face on Mars or the Sphinx. This is an image that's carved into a valley wall. It's a low bas relief, and so it's very sensitive to because of it's not very deep in its sculptural form. Relies a lot on light and shadow, you know, from creating the formation. So in 2000, NASA released this image, and really caught the attention of a lot of people. Besides the national press conference, this was featured in the New York Post.
I second, hold
on the line there.
Oh, but, hey, that's our other guest. Sorry about that. Hang on 1 second, Rand. We're almost ready for you. One
like
second.
Like a party line.
It's a party line. Hang on 1 second. Anyhow, go ahead. Go ahead, George. Sorry about that.
Yeah. Well, at least you got a hold of him.
Yeah. Well, this we've had nothing but technical errors here, but continue with this face. Go ahead.
Right. So, like I said, it was featured, I guess, because of the press conference. The New York Post in New York had a feature, an article about it. It was on Good Morning America, and it was on the old Fox News, I guess, Channel 5 in New York. So it did get a lot of attention at the time. And then, of course, you know, we're waiting for more images. And the newest image, it took 10 years for NASA to photograph this formation again.
And now, tell me, was this a NASA or was this a European Space Agency image, the follow-ups?
No, the original image was NASA, the Mars Global Surveyor,
right.
And the two
right.
newer images, which were taken in 2010, they were from the Mars Reconnaissance High-Rise Camera.
Okay, now I'm going to be
Space
posting
Agency.
This for. Okay, go ahead.
I haven't seen any images of this formation from the European Space Agency.
Okay, so I'm going to post this image today. You'll see it on the Facebook page of Earth Ancients, along with the link that from the Cydonia Institute. For our audience, give us, and this is quite a unique, and we are not going to be able to give the analysis until after it's been submitted. Is that correct?
Yeah, I sent you a copy of the paper, but the paper is kind of like, you know, top secret until it's published in
right.
the Journal of Space Exploration. These journals,
right.
they don't like anything to be publicly, you know, printed prior to publication. So although we can, you know, talk about some of the images and stuff, I don't want to get into too much of the detail that we're revealing in the paper.
Right.
But we're hoping that'll probably be published hopefully this fall.
Okay. So tell me
science
who...
Science is a very, very slow and laborious process.
It is. And we had Dr. Brandenburg on recently, who discussed his research and the time, you know, many years to get to his conclusion on the face of Mars, surface of Mars. But did you have a body of scientists working with you to come up with the analysis? Were there some people who have been studying that area?
Yes. The lead author of the paper is William Saunders. He's a geologist. He's a co-author of mine. We've put out a few books, and he's also a member of the Society for Planetary SETI Research and a member of the Cydonia Institute. And he's the lead writer. He's a geologist. Myself, my background is in art. What I tell people is I know artwork when I see it. I have a background in sculpture. And what we're seeing here on Mars with the crown face is a composite image of three sliced faces that are partial faces conjoined
yes.
together. And at first, people
yes.
may think, well, that's crazy. Who would do that? And if when doing research with Mesoamerican cultures, we find this is a common composite idea that was practiced throughout the New World. The
yes.
other author is we have another geologist on the paper, Michael Dale, and then we have an image analyst, and his name is James Miller. He's out in New Jersey.
Okay.
So there's four of us.
Now I
want to.
Yeah. So you had a group of people who have studied this image, who have done previous research on that Cydonia. Now this is how close is this to the Cydonia face? How close is this image?
Well, you had Dr. Brandenburg on, who was talking about the two nuclear explosions that there's overwhelming evidence for, one that took place just above Cydonia and the other one over in the Utopia plain. This is just below where the second face is. It's down in Libya Mounds area. And
okay.
right on the outskirts of where probably a large ocean would be. So we're finding all of these structures. I know California is going through a big drought now, but all of these formations, like the face on Mars, the second face, this the crown face features, these are all found around major water areas that NASA has shown that, you know, these were the paleo oceans, that, you know, the birth of Mars and all this time. They had oceans, you know, all over the planet.
Right.
And,
okay.
You know, of course, now they're all dead, but we're finding a lot of these formations, you know, pyramidal structures and things, and these pictographic images all around where water would be. And you find the same thing here on Earth, where, you know, cultures grow up around water.
Okay. So tell us real quickly.
California die around where there's no water.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny because John,
you know,
did mention that. Yeah, it's interesting that there were huge oceans, and that NASA's now admits and agrees with John Brandenburg that there were these paleo oceans that were huge and covered a good portion of the planet. Now, in the case of this crown face, give us, if you wouldn't mind, the dimensions of the size, the actual height and width, estimated.
Yeah, it's pretty large. Everything on Mars, like the face on Mars, is basically, it's a mile and a half from chin to forehead, and it's about a mile wide. So everything we're finding up there is very large. These are massive structures. And the dimensions of the crown face, it's almost a mile across and a mile high. It's basically the three faces almost form a square. It's like a square imaged area. So this is pretty large.
It's a massive size. Just a couple of more questions, and then we're going to let you go. But thank you for being on the program. What is your Dr. Brandenburg believes that the people who built these were not that sophisticated. The people that bombed them were sophisticated or nuked them. But in your estimation, what would you say the level of sophistication was on these? Because in my feeling, my research, and my looking at the surface of the planet, these massive 1.5 mile long features were made to show to be seen from high elevations, which to my mind meant the society had perhaps some form of airplane or propulsion system that would fly over them and see them, or somebody entering the orbit or the atmosphere
of
Mars.
Yeah.
Okay.
These things are so large that you know, the best way to view them is being orbiting the planet. And
right.
I spoke to, I was at the Space Technology and Applications International Forum with Dr. Brandenburg back in March when we had our conference. And we had discussed that. Brandenburg thinks a lot of these structures, because of the nuclear attack that he's working on, the synopsis there, is that he's thinking these people that built these structures were probably Bronze Age.
Yes.
That also in his book. Bill and I, we kind of differ. We think these were sophisticated, a group of a civilization that was very high-tech. And they may have had a, you know, mutual war with this culture that destroyed them. And this is how, you know, they obviously lost. And a lot of this information, if you go into Zachariah Sitchin and you look at the Sumerians and the Anunnaki, the story of the Anunnaki with NK and EA and Marduk, you know, being exiled to Mars with the Igi, and there were battles between the two brothers. There's evidence in Sumerian texts that talk about these battles that went on between the brothers. So this may be some, you know, Earth evidence here that we have in some of these ancient scripts that talk about this destruction. And even in the Mesoamerican culture, in a town called Naranjo, which we mentioned in our first book, the archaeologists discovered all of this whole history of this, which the archaeologists call, this is not my terminology, they call the Star Wars. There was a Star War between Tikal and Naranjo and this third Earth place, which was Mars.
Okay. Fascinating.
Planet. Yeah. Well, we're gonna... a whole can of worms here, Cliff.
Well, you are, George. But you know what? I think NASA, as John says to us, NASA knows this is here, JPL refuses to give us the evidence, but the government is just, I mean, it's just a matter of time before they say, well, as John calls it, there is archaeology on planet Mars.
Right.
I mean, look, this is archaeology.
Right. The evidence that Dr. Brandenburg uses in his book has all been provided by NASA. I mean, it's out there. You just have to connect the dots. But they're not coming forward and saying this happened. They've even were thinking that this could have happened with the Viking lander. All the evidence they were getting for that pointed towards some kind of nuclear problem on Mars.
Yeah. I mean, come on, people. This is getting old, you know?
Right.
Open. I mean, just turn off. Just give it to us. Say, hey, we have found ruins on Mars. What's going to happen? You know what I mean?
You have a group of people out there that will cut heads off and blow up monuments. So I think that's
think there's a feeling that people might jump out of the window and
masses
or something. Okay, listen, George, thank you very much for joining us for a few minutes and giving us this update. I will post this photograph as well as the link.
Anybody out there wants some information, they can contact us at the Sidonia Institute. There's information on our website. We have contact information. Just we're here to talk about it.
Why don't you give us the website again? Give us the website again.
I'll just type in the Sidonia Institute.
Okay, SidoniaInstitute.com.
It'll come right up on Google, or you can contact us through the Society for Planetary Study Research.
Okay, very good. Thank
right,
you.
Cliff.
Great,
thank you.
Great
good
material.
Good luck with your next guest. I'm glad he called.
All
in.
Right.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Well, there you have it. That's an update on this amazing crown face. And I have seen it, and I thought my eyes were playing tricks on me. This is about a year ago. And actually, it's much more than a trick of light. It's an actual monument. And you can take a look at it, and I think you'll be as impressed as I am. So take a look at it on Facebook, and I'll post more information on it later. So we talked about Moses a few weeks ago with Scott Allen Robert and Dr. John Ward in their book Exodus Reality. In that book and in that discussion, they described an event that was very similar to some kind of a tsunami caused by a asteroid or an incoming planet-sized event that devastated Earth. And not only what the Bible says were Hebrews, but quite a few Egyptians. And we learned a little bit about the man known as Moses. In their estimation, they find it more of a tale of an actual person. Today's topic is actually the man known as Moses. And we have with us who has just called in, and I have to apologize for dialing him up. I had some problems there. We have Rand Flem-Auth, who has been with us before. We had Rand discussing Atlantis, and he and his wife Rose wrote When the Sky Fell, which was a great book. I really enjoyed it. Rand is has a master's degree in labor and a BA in sociology and anthropology, and he has published a number of books, but his most famous is the one that he and Rose wrote. And this new work is quite unique. It's called Killing Moses, Solving History's Cold Case Mystery. Welcome to the program, Rand.
Oh, thanks for having me, Cliff.
Yeah, sorry we had a little technical problem there. I was dialing you earlier, and it wouldn't go through, and then you sent me a number, and I go, okay, here we go. Yeah, I have a virtual monitor here a studio that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. So thank you for being able to enjoy us. But this book is quite unique. I've read a couple of articles on this book that you've written. And what got you going? I mean, I read the reference. Sigmund Freud spent a good 40 years on of Moses, I mean, he was basically obsessed with this issue. Is that what got you triggered on this?
Not really, but certainly Freud did spend nearly 40 years of his life in secret, incidentally, working on what he believed to be a unique interpretation of what happened with Moses. And it was his last book. Many of the people that he knew, scientists that he knew, urged him not to publish because it was so controversial. And he did publish in some journals, but he did it anonymously. He didn't do it under his real name. But then he ultimately left Austria, having been driven out by the Nazis, if you like, and went to London. And he was in his 80s, early 80s, and he just decided to take all this research he'd been doing for 40 years and put it together as a book. Came out as a book in September 1939, and he died that month. So he didn't really get a chance to defend his theory, and of course events kind of overtook interest in his writings. And that whole theory that Moses had been murdered and been replaced by an imposter, which was his theory, was basically just forgotten. And we, as your listeners might know, I mean, Rose and I are known for Atlantis and Earth crust displacement, ancient maps, deluge in the world. So when we took when we were researching Atlantis, for example, we thought, like, there's been a lot of books written on Atlantis, like second only to the Bible, and we had to have something unique to bring to it, and what we brought to it was the theory of Earth crust displacement, which we had corresponded with Charles Hapgood with. We brought to it a deep study of world mythology related to the flood, particularly any events that occurred at the flood or before the flood, and we brought to it ancient maps that were accurate of long before Europeans had explored the world. So that's the kind of set, the triangulation that we took when the sky fell. That book took 17 years to research and write.
Wow.
And on Moses, lots has been written about Moses in the Bible, and so we needed to have another unique perspective to be able to do that. And kind of comparable to the ancient maps was our study of ancient Egyptian illusions, acts of illusion, magic as acts of illusion, showmanship, if you like. And that is not a really well-known thing, and there's that has given us some insights that we didn't have otherwise. Comparable to the flood myths and the myths that we did for Atlantis is Jewish folklore about the events around the time of Moses. And the interesting thing about Jewish folklore is that it is kind of the unofficial version of what happens. One has to understand that there was... when Israel was first united, Judah and Israel were for 70 years, they were one country, and then they split into two. And the north was Israel and the south was Judah. Now, in the north, there were the 10 tribes, so-called the 10 lost 10 tribes. They they were overthrown after a couple of centuries by the Assyrians. Then they became refugees, and they were poor refugees, and they had to go to Judah, which was sort of kind of like present-day Israel, more of the highlands there, and where Jerusalem is and all that. But they weren't in charge. The people who were in charge were the people who ultimately edited the Bible. So their stories, which were more favorable to Joseph, were lost, and they only were preserved in folklore. So we use Jewish folklore to give us some sort of glimmering of what was the alternative perspective of what was happening during the Exodus. So that's what we're doing there, like we did with world myths about the flood and Lost Island Paradise. That was the
right.
What it is, it gives you a different picture to be trying to put the puzzle together with. That's what we did with Atlantis. And now we're using Jewish folklore to bring together a different perspective on what happened during the Exodus and what happened to Moses.
Right. Now, you actually state that, and I don't know if this is what you and Rose discovered, but you revealed known Roman documents that record Jesus Christ's formative adult in Egypt. And that's a trigger point in this book. Can you tell us a little bit about how I find that fascinating?
Sure. Jesus was very much enamored by Moses. The story of Jesus that we get in the Gospels, the four Gospels, are Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are trying to counter the prevailing opinion in the Roman world, which was that Jesus was a magician, that he was just an Egyptian-trained magician, and that he was clever and he was outwitting the people. That was the perspective of the Romans. Ultimately, the perspective of the Romans gets washed away by the victory of Christianity, if you like, and ultimately, but there are few commentaries, they're Christian commentaries, on Roman writers. So when they're commenting on these Roman writers, they repeat their arguments, and in one of them, in one of these repetitions, they repeat the arguments of a Greek philosopher, Celsus, who lived about the time of Jesus, who argued that Jesus had left Palestine, the area of Palestine, and gone to Egypt when he was younger, a young man, and stayed there until he was 30. Some people think it's like 12 to 30 he was there. And during that time, he learned to be a magician, in the sense of an Egyptian magician. That's a much bigger thing than a magician is today. You're a doctor, astronomer, all sorts of things, right? But a part of the things that you learned it was always a mentoring thing. You always went with somebody and you watched and studied them and learned to become a magician by watching and studying. Part of the things that he learned was the use of puppetry, the use of hypnotism. These are some of the things that the Romans felt that Jesus was using.
Okay, let me stop you right there, Rand. This is something that I find a little bit disturbing, but very interesting. You describe your discovery of, and I don't want to say it's a cult class, but a body of Egyptian study of a magic work or working as a magician. And yes, the description that I got from your work, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that this was a form of, well, sleight of hand, not so much sleight of hand, but using illusion to fool people. And according to you, Jesus, his hero was Moses, who was a magician.
That's
Tell us about that, because that throws all the miracles out the window, and makes us all wonder if what we're reading about in the Bible is all a fantasy for what this trained illusionist was doing to people. Tell us what a magician is.
Okay, so to understand, an Egyptian magician is completely different than our concept of a magician today. A magician mm-hmm. today is a showman who uses
right.
illusions for entertainment. Okay? Now, a magician in ancient Egypt at the time that Jesus was there, and this was true when Moses was there as well, was a much more learned person than a present day. He could be a doctor. He'd be a doctor, an astronomer, a mathematician, and acts of illusion would be part and parcel of the things that he learned. And they would use acts of illusion for political purposes. Let me give you an example. If there was the pharaoh died and there was no clear apparent successor, the high priest would be chosen to select the next leader. And so what would happen is that all the priests would march in front of a man holding a pole, and at the top of the pole was a little guy up there, and he was sitting at the top of the pole, and he just was stationary. And as people went by one, and when he would nod, and that person would become the high priest. That high priest would then decide who the pharaoh was. What it was inside the pole was a string held by the person who held the pole. And when they wanted their buddy or whoever they assigned in secret to become the high priest to select the new pharaoh, they pulled the string. So this is puppetry for politics.
Mm-hmm.
And what we show in Killing Moses is that puppetry for politics is what happened. It was used in the story of Moses. There were other acts of illusion along these lines, hypnotism. These things were a part and parcel of a magician's toolkit, if you like. Now, I'm not. Our book is not mainly about Jesus. Jesus is the last chapter of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Our book is mainly about the two people who were Moses, and we believe the first person who was Moses, and this is according to Roman accounts, and also from Jewish folklore, the Lost Tribes folklore, was that he was the son of Joseph, born after Joseph had died, and his mother, Asenath, was a high priestess of the temple of Heliopolis, which is a very, very ancient city in Egypt and highly regarded. It was from there that Akhenaten first came up with the idea of monotheism.
Mm-hmm.
And her father was the high priest there. So Moses, as the son of Joseph, and this is what Jewish folklore tells us, is that Moses is the son of Joseph, not this long descendant from this other color character, Levi, which I'll get into in a bit. But he was descended from Joseph, and then lived in the temple, grew up as an Egyptian, and only later, when there was a change in the pharaoh, did he have to leave. So this first Moses was very much in the tradition of Akhenaten, monotheism, and he left and joined the rest of the family, which had been expelled from Egypt much earlier. And
mm-hmm.
that's when you get into the second Moses, and this is the second Moses is in his motive and what he did.
How did the first die, as far as you can figure out?
He was killed on the mountain of God when he went up and did not come down for 40 days. When he went up, he was killed at that point. When the person who came to be known as Moses came down, he was wearing, his face was shining so much, and all the people, and this is one of the illusions, all the people believed that the reflection of God's face-to-face encounter with Moses had caused Moses' faces to glow. And they were afraid to look at his face because they thought even the reflection would kill them. So immediately they're looking away. So they're not looking very carefully at his face, because if they do, they fear they die. So it's not, and this is the second Moses. He then puts a veil over his face so that they can look at him, so they can see his head and the veil, but they can't see his face. This is the new Moses. This is the second Moses. And his first act is to kill 3,000 of the Israelites who he thought were a threat to his new power. That's
3,000?
That's an act of illusion. The shining face, the veil, for political purposes, to take control of for the rest of the duration of the Exodus. Nobody sees this second Moses' face except his inner circle. And one by one, they are killed off, as we show in the book. So in the end, nobody saw his face. They didn't know, but he took control of his name was Reuel.
Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead. You want to say something?
This is what I want to talk about. So Reuel is this individual who takes over the identity of Moses. Is he a magician too?
Absolutely. He was Reuel's father was Esa. Esa, who founded Edom. Esa was the twin brother of Jacob. Jacob, who becomes Israel. His name is changed from Jacob to Israel. So they're twins, not identical twins, but fraternal twins. Esa is the older son. Their father is Isaac, the founder of the Jews. Esa is supposed to be the heir because he's the firstborn. But when it comes to the time for Isaac to transfer the power of the leadership of the Hebrew people from himself to his son, Jacob, the younger son, impersonates Esa and gets the blessing of Isaac and then becomes the leader of the Jews. So Esa is then disinherited from what his rightful place as the firstborn son. He goes off. He conquers a land. It's called Edom. It's like present-day Jordan. He has sons. One of his sons is Reuel. So Reuel grows up with his uncle, Jacob, who later is known as Israel, as the person who had stolen the power of the leadership of the Jews from his father. So he had a strong motive to try to regain that power. And the only way he could do that was to have some skills. Now, in Edom, at the time, Edom was a colony of Egypt. And at the time, and for several centuries, actually, the pharaohs, the sons of the leaders of the colonies of Egypt would come to Egypt to learn, to be educated. They would become magicians, priests, and that meant everything that the Egyptians knew. And so Reuel, as a young man, went to Egypt and then became a magician. And according to Jewish folklore, he was a very, very successful magician, so much so that he was employed by the pharaoh as one of the principal advisors. And this shows up in Jewish folklore all the time, of Reuel being an advisor to the pharaoh. So he was a very skilled and powerful person in Egypt, but then when he was, for some reason that we don't know, had to leave, and he went to this oasis called Median. It's in present-day Saudi Arabia. And that's where the first Moses, when he left, ended up as well. So the first Moses came to be in the power of Reuel in this oasis in Median. It's a long story, and it seems a little bit complicated, and I understand that. But here's the thing about killing Moses is everything that's in there is consistent and coherent as opposed to what we get in the Bible. And let me tell you why what's wrong with what we get in the Bible, and particularly in the Torah, the first five books. One of the big conflict in the Old Testament before Moses is the conflict between Joseph, the favored son of Israel, and Levi, his older brother, but from a different mother, who they have a conflict, and they are you have heard of, I'm sure of the attempt to throw Joseph into a pit to kill him, and then he is saved and is sold into slavery into Egypt. He then makes his way and eventually through this rags-to-riches kind of thing, he becomes the right-hand man of the Pharaoh. And so Joseph is a very, very powerful and influential person. And when the rest of the Israelites, particularly Levi and the other elder sons, Judah, Reuben, Simeon, get to Egypt. Israel disguises himself. Joseph disguises himself, and they don't recognize him because they haven't seen him for like 10 years or so. And then he eventually reveals who he is. And according to Jewish folklore, it looks as though Levi then kills Joseph. And that's what leads to the expulsion. In the Egyptian records, the Exodus is not a let my people go and free thing. It's a expulsion of people who hold dangerous beliefs. And the dangerous belief that they held was the belief in a single God. Because the Egyptians perceived monotheism as a threat to their own religion. And they really hated Akhenaten, who at first introduced it. He was a pharaoh. They tried to destroy everything about him. We only know about Akhenaten through archaeology, not through Egyptian records, because everything about Akhenaten in Egyptian records was destroyed because they hated it. But it became a secret religion. It went underground, and it went underground in Heliopolis. And it was in Heliopolis that Joseph's wife, Asenath, was a high priest, and her father was the high priest. So when Joseph was killed, Moses was raised by his mother in the temple of Heliopolis, which was the secret center of monotheism in Egypt. And that's where monotheism came from, in our view, from Moses, the first Moses's. The Egyptians called him Osirseth, Osar for Osiris, the fellow who was killed by his brother, and that's what happened to Joseph. He was killed by his brother Levi, and then Seth for Joseph. So Osirseth was the name that the Egyptian records give to the leader of the Jews. And he later is then known as Moses, even within the Egyptian record. But initially he's known as Osirseth, which is a combination of an Egyptian mythology where the brother is killed by a brother, and Joseph, who also suffered the same fate, according to Jewish folklore. So it's a completely different account of what's happening in the Bible. And what's happening, here's the thing, that Levi was hated Joseph, and then, of course, he would have hated Joseph's son as well. And Levi and Reuel became the leaders in Midian before the Israelites went into the Promised Land. And during that time, Levi became the leader of the Levites, and the Levites ultimately became the scribes, and the scribes ultimately put together all the oral stories that make up the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, and and they decide what's going to be in there and what isn't going to be in there, and in our perspective, the Torah is basically a polemical argument for the Levites to give them power, which they got, and to diminish the role of Joseph, which they did. So that's what. So Levi's motive was that he hated Joseph because Joseph was the favored son of Israel and from a different mother. And so the whole thing is a family squabble, if you like, that is then told by one particular perspective, and that is Levi. And the only way we can get a different perspective on it is to look at what the lost tribes of Israel had to say, and that's in Jewish folklore.
Okay, so what I would love for you to tell me is you're taking Jewish folklore. But then you and Rose discovered these Roman documents. What is the path that you found this on? I mean, is it mostly the folklore is the foundation and of the research, and then the documents kind of give credence to this so-called story? Or how did you come about?
If you like the in the case of Atlantis, for example. It's the story of the lost island paradise that existed before the flood, and the events that occurred at the flood, which include a falling sky or a change in the sun, all those things that gave us a blueprint, if you liked, to look at the whole question of Atlantis in a new light. The same thing is happening. We're doing, and we've done the same. Like it's been 15 years. I've been doing this. We've taken Jewish folklore, and it's given us a different picture to look at. And the one we get in the Torah, the one we get in the Bible, is the official version of the people who were victorious in the past, the Levites. They were victorious in the sense that they became the scribes. They were the ones who put the Bible together. They were the ones who decided what was going in and what wasn't going in. And they basically made all the pieces fit their perspective of it. And what we're saying is that when you look into Jewish folklore, the folklore of the lost tribes of Israel, all the other tribes, not Levi and not Judah, but all the other tribes, they have a much more favorable attitude towards Joseph, and they regard Moses as the son of Joseph. So this is a very different perspective than what is in the Bible, because in the Bible, Moses is a Levite, descended after 400 years of bondage. What we found is that whole story of the 430 years of bondage is just a smokescreen that didn't really exist. It didn't exist at all. They've never found any archaeological evidence for it. And they've been looking for it for centuries now, or more, a couple of centuries. The whole 430 years of bondage was simply a smokescreen, because what Levi did, Israel was not happy with Levi. In fact, in his last will and testament before he died, he made Levi an outlaw. He not only did he disinherit him. This is in Genesis 48, if anybody wants to look. And he made him an outlaw. People couldn't even associate with him. So Levi had to reinvent himself. And so what he did is he reinvented himself as Aaron. the brother of Moses, so-called, the brother of Miriam, who was supposed to be the sister of Moses. Actually, what Miriam was, Miriam was just Dinah, who had been the only daughter of Israel, who had been raped and was disgraced. She needed a new identity, too. So Reuel provided Levi with a new identity. He became Aaron, the high priest. And Dinah, a new identity. She became Miriam, the prophetess. And they became elevated rather than discarded, as they had been. And so then they become victorious in the end, because they're the ones who ultimately control the pen. And whoever controls the pen controls the story. And what we're saying is, in this particular case, in the case of Moses, the people who were involved in the death of Moses, Reuel and Levi, were successful in their eradication of the true story of Moses, which was monotheism. The Ten Commandments came right out of the first Moses as well. The rest of the 623 laws that have been added, those are all bogus in our view. It's all added to and means of making more power for the Levites. The Levites were the only ones who could become the priests. They controlled the priesthood, and they controlled the pen. And that was their ultimate faith. And when you would take a look at what Israel had to say about Levi, it doesn't fit into a person of high moral standard. He was called cruel. He was called, considered sarcastic, cruel, and, virtually evil. He went behind Israel's back and killed off the people who had supposedly raped Dinah. We don't know whether it was a rape or she consented. That story is, we don't know. But anyway, he went against his father's orders and killed the people of the village that were involved. So as a result, he was disinherited, as was his brother Simeon and his other older brother Reuben. The only one who wasn't of that family that wasn't disinherited by Israel was Judah, and that became the other kingdom besides of Israel, and the one that survived for another couple hundred years after Israel had been destroyed. So the events conspired to give power to the Levites, and they covered up the story of what had happened. Now, we believe that Jesus, through his studies in Egypt and his study of the Torah, was able to discern what had happened, and that Moses had been killed. And the death of the father required the sacrifice of a son. And Jesus decided that he was going to be the sacrificial son that would atone for the murder of the father. So Jesus, apart from dying for the sins of humanity, which he did, also was specifically trying to die to atone for the murder of the father figure, Moses. So basically,
so he went about, according to you, he went about insulting a number of high priests and people in government, just as Jesus now, and eventually was and then later crucified. You're saying?
Well, Jesus had determined that he was going to die. He was willing to die, and he was willing to die for the atonement for his hero, Moses. And he thought, what had happened is, like, from the time of Moses, say, and there's different opinions about how long it was, but it could have been as much as 1,000 years before Jesus, there was the Edomites, where Reuel was in power. At the time of Moses, we believe the Levites and the Edomites were in control. They were in power. Then, after the conquest of the Promised Land, the Levites kept control of the priesthood, but political power shifted to Judah and his descendants. The Edomites were out of power, and they were out of power for like 1,000 years. Then, about 70 years before Jesus was born, well, it was actually Mark Anthony. It was Mark Anthony and Cleopatra who raised Herod the Great. Herod was an Edomite, and they made him the king of the Jews. So once, for 1,000 years, the old alliance of the Edomites and the Levites had been dormant, and then it became came into existence again just before Jesus came on the scene. Herod the Great was the person who built the temple, when Jesus, the people who were in power at the time that Jesus came were Joseph Caiaphas, who was a Levite, and Herod's son Herod Antipas, who was a leader of Galilee. But these two Jesus poked at. He poked at them consistently to try to egg them on to do something against him, going into the temple and overturning the money changers. That struck right at the Levites, one of their sources of income. Threatening to expose a secret, saying that the builders of the temple, their ancestors were the ones who murdered prophets. And he's saying this during the time of the Passover, so it's clear that the prophet that he meant was Moses. So he was threatening to expose the Levites as being conspirators in the death of Moses. And had that actually come about, they would have lost their power. So they cooked up a charge of blasphemy and had him crucified.
Wow. Man, this is a story. Pretty amazing. There is another area, a passage in your book that I want to ask you about also. I consider it kind of a symbol of a Hebrew hierarchy, and that's the Ark of the Covenant. And
yes,
many of us talk about it and have read about it being a number of things, from a communication device of off-world beings, communicate with them, to some kind of a weapon. And you describe it as a coffin. Holds the skull and bones.
Let me just say that, first of all, the dimensions of the Ark of the Covenant are exactly that of an Egyptian coffin, and it isn't, mm-hmm. and the body can't be laid out; it has to be disarticulated to fit in. Mm-hmm. Now we believe that Reuel, the person who with Levi killed the first Moses and then became the second Moses. He needed a place to keep all his paraphernalia, his magic show, if you like, not to mention the bones of Moses, were somewhere where nobody would look. So he put it right out front. He put it in the Ark of the Covenant, and he had people walk with it. If you touched it, you died, and all this. He made a whole mystique around it. And then when each time, at the end of each day, as they walked, they would put it in a tent, and then they would put a curtain around it so that nobody could see. And it was just like the veil in the face of Moses. It was another way of preventing people from seeing what was going on behind the scenes. And so the whole thing, we believe that ultimately what was in the Ark of the Covenant was the head and skull of the first Moses, and probably some of the paraphernalia that Ruel used to do some of his tricks, maybe some gold. But it was his sort of private chest, if you liked, and he turned it into a mystique so people were afraid of it, and that way nobody looked at it. Now, two of Aaron's sons did try to take a look at it. They crept in. They were the ones who used to carry it all the time. They would set it up, they would put the curtain around it, and then one day they decided they were going to go in there and look themselves. And they went up there, and lo and behold, they're incinerated. They are killed. Fire comes out from it, and they are killed. And this is the story that actually got me on to the whole thing of the illusions, because the reaction of Moses and Aaron is very peculiar. Aaron is about to tear at his clothes like they did when they lost somebody. And Moses says to him, don't do that, because you have the oil on you as well. In other words, what happens is, before you go up and pay homage to Yahweh, who is supposed to reside inside the Ark of the Covenant, you have to put this oil on, and this oil is flammable. Egyptian magicians were fire experts. And what happened was, when these sons came up to offer their what's called strange incense, they were really just trying to look inside the Ark of the Covenant by themselves. But as they got up, they triggered something, or perhaps Ruel was in there and just let loose the flames. And since they were completely covered in the inflammable, it's like being dosed in gasoline and then walking up to a bonfire. Poof, you're gone. And that's what happened to Aaron's sons. And rather than being sympathetic to them, Moses says, and this is right in Leviticus, Moses says to Aaron, don't go tearing your clothes, because if you do, you too could be incinerated. So that made me think it wasn't supernatural. It wasn't God doing this. It was a flammable liquid on their body that made them vulnerable to flames coming out from behind the veil.
God. You know, I have to ask you, Rand, this whole magician thing really changes the whole look of these individuals, because the original Moses studied these sacred arts. And would you call them sacred arts, or would you just call them present-day illusionists? Well, obviously much more sophisticated than a present-day illusionist, but it's still in some ways sacred, because you have to, like as you said, have a mentor accept you into these teachings, correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And here's one thing that I'd like to get over to people about hypnotism. The hypnotism, according to Egyptian records, was around as early as the time of the Great Pyramids. It was 1,000 years old, maybe even 1,500 years old, when the first Moses, that is, Osirsef, the son of Joseph, the first Moses, the authentic Moses, if you like, was at the Temple of Heliopolis, learning from his grandfather, the high priest, all the secrets of Egyptian knowledge. One of the things that he would learn was hypnotism, a study that had been going on for 1,000 or maybe even 1,500 years. And so their knowledge of hypnotism was much more sophisticated than ours. Our knowledge of hypnotism is 150 years old. They had 10 times as much time they had things called sleep temples. People would come there with ailments, and they would be hypnotized, and they would be cured. Hypnotism was a much more powerful tool in ancient Egypt than it is in present-day modern society. So that's one of the skills that Moses has, and I think the burning bush was a case of here's the deal. The first Moses would be, when he was left Egypt and was in Midian, where Ruel, who was known as Jethro in Christian terminology, but that was just a title. It meant His Excellency. When Jethro had Moses come into his tent, he would say, "Take off your shoes. You're coming into sacred territory, and listen." And that was the clue that this is he's going to be now into a trance, and he's going to be educated and instructed in things. So when you get up to when Moses gets up to the mountain and encounters the burning bush, the first thing that the voice from the burning bush says is, "Take off your shoes. You're on sacred territory." That puts him right into the trance, and then he just follows whatever Ruel decides he experienced. That's what he experienced.
It's amazing, tremendous amount of manipulation, and obviously, these folklores are written in such a way that it becomes the Bible, which is what millions of people have faith around. So it really makes you think twice about Iraq and how it was developed.
Well, going back to Atlantis, for example, the Earth crust displacement theory was the thing that sort of put the whole Atlantis in Antarctica thing into context. That's the thing that I did with that. So, and that was the thing that Graham Hancock took with Fingerprints of the Gods when he had our manuscript. So that sort of gave a skeleton to the whole thing. The skeleton to killing Moses is not visible. We don't really get into it because it's rather boring. It's textual studies. It's called the documentary hypothesis, and it's been around for. It's the way of looking at the Bible. If you go to Harvard or go to Yale or any place where you're learning theology, you're going to have to study the documentary hypothesis. When I was using Earth crust displacement on trying to solve Atlantis, I was using something that was a different paradigm than the existing geological paradigm. The existing geological paradigm is gradualism, uniformitarianism, and Earth crust displacement was catastrophic change of the whole shifting of the outer crust of the shell of the Earth, catastrophically. So, like, that was a radical alternative to the paradigm. In killing Moses, it's radical, but it's not radical it's within the paradigm. The paradigm is documentary hypothesis that there are four or five, maybe six, different parts or sources for the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, and that these have been put together to create an impression. We see it more as a cover-up. That's our radical perspective within the documentary hypothesis, is that we see the Torah as a cover-up of the murder of Moses. And that cover-up is undertaken by Levite scribes who are protecting their ancestor. And that's why when Jesus said in Matthew, you know, you are hypocrites, you build temples, King Herod's temple in Jerusalem had just been completed at the time that Jesus was there. But pretending that you are homaging to these prophets like Moses, but really your ancestors killed the prophets. And in other words, what really happened is your ancestor was the person responsible for the death of Moses. And that's what Jesus is saying. That's our unique take on the Gospels, is that what Jesus is saying and what he's trying to really aggravate the existing power structure with is the threat to expose that their ancestors were involved in the death of Moses. And Joseph Caliphate, who was a Levite, and Herod Antipas, who was an Edomite, were indeed descendants of Ruel and levy. So the same parties that had destroyed Moses, ultimately were responsible for the death of Jesus. And that was something that Jesus wanted to happen. He wanted to expose it. But he threatened to expose it, but it worked better for him if it wasn't exposed, because then he becomes the sacrificial son who atones for the murder of the father.
Did you find in your Roman documents some, obviously it doesn't go back to Moses because the Romans weren't there around then, but when you're doing this research, is it passages where this individual known as Jesus is making these claims about Moses?
Here's the deal. In the first century, a Greek philosopher who was sympathetic with the Romans, called Celsus, wrote a book against the Christians, and he said in it that Moses was the son of Joseph, and there was no great time between the time of Joseph and Moses. Which is not what we get in the Bible. In the Bible, we get Joseph dies, 430 years of bondage, then Moses is born. So his book didn't survive, as most of the books that were anti-Christian, they didn't survive. However, in the 3rd or 4th century, a Christian writer wrote a critique of Celsus, and in it he quotes him. And so that's how we know what Celsus was thinking. So it's indirect. It's not direct. It's indirect. They both are going back to something even more ancient and more important, and that is Manetho. Manetho was the first Egyptian historian. His dynasty breakdown is the one that Egyptologists rather, use today. He was the one who told the story of the Exodus as being an expulsion of people who had, he called them lepers, but it meant in that time, it was a polemical term. It meant that their ideas were polluted. And the idea, the polluted idea that they didn't even want to use was the idea of a single God. And that was the thing that they couldn't stand about Moses, as he believed in that. And so he and his followers were expelled. It wasn't a let my people go. They were kicked out. And when they were kicked out, and they may very well have been kicked out because of the murder of Joseph. Joseph was a high official. He was a Hebrew who was a high official. And Levi probably killed him. And there is Jewish folklore to that effect, that's why they expelled the Jews, because they had been participated in the death of a high Egyptian official who happened to be Jewish himself. That was Joseph. Joseph was dead. His wife was pregnant with Moses, and that's why Israel, when he disenfranchises his first two sons, takes the first two sons of Joseph and makes them his sons, and then he says to Ansiath that any future children born, she was obviously pregnant, should have an Egyptian name and will be in your inheritance, and that was Moses, and so he got an Egyptian name. And the Egyptian name that Asenath proposed, according to Matthew, was Osirseph. And Osirseph, Osiris, remember, is the most important god in Egyptian mythology. He is murdered by his brother, and then his nephew kills him. And this was the story that inspired Reuel. Reuel was the nephew of Israel, and he wanted revenge against Israel because his father had been lost the leadership of the Jews by impersonating his father. So the perfect way to do that was kill Joseph's son and then impersonate him. And that's what Ruel did, in our view.
What I have to have more clarification on is, if Ruel went up to the mountain where Moses was, killed Moses, and came down, and of course he was too intensely bright to look at, that's good in the beginning, but there were probably hundreds of people who knew the real Moses. Why wasn't Ruel, how was he not outed early?
See, that's why 3,000 people were killed. His first thing that he did, the very first thing he did, this whole rebellion of the golden calf thing was a setup by Levi and Ruel to identify anybody who might be a problem later. Ruel comes down with a shining face and puts a veil on, what's his first commandment? What's his first thing that he says? Take Levites, go out and kill all these rebels. 3,000 people were killed. That's right in the Bible. And so the very first act of the new Moses, or the second Moses, is an order of death, a death sentence for all the people who could be. Here's another thing. If anybody wants to look at this without reading the book, because obviously people do that, if you wanted to just get the Bible and go to Exodus 18, you'll have Ruel, and that is, think of it as an exercise in hypnotism. In that story, Moses is there, sitting there, supposedly taking care. This is the first Moses as well, don't forget, taking care of all things. And then along comes Ruel, called Jethro at this point, and he says, oh, this thing is too heavy for you. And as soon as he says that, everything that Jethro says, Ruel does. And that whole book, Exodus 18, is just a perfect example of hypnotism, a hypnotic control of Jethro of the first Moses. So read it back. And then if you want another example, then there's the whole thing about Balaam, because that later at the end, that's probably too complicated to get into. But there's another story there of illusions that are effective, and also the whole some of this stuff has been we've put out on our on Ancient Origins a website out of Australia. And there's a few articles on there that you can see them from Flemish.com.
Yeah, I am definitely going to post some of the articles so that people get a sense of this work that you and Rose have completed. The book is Killing Moses, Solving History's Oldest Cold Case Mystery. In the closing moments, Rand, the book's been out for a while, right? A few months, so maybe 6 months?
We released it in December. Here's the deal. People, the public, there you go, are afraid of this. They're afraid of it. They won't do it. They won't.
Are they really?
No. They won't do it. And so we had to do it ourselves. So we did it through Amazon. And you're not going to, if you're listening to this now, folks, I'm not going to be on the television. I'm not going to be in your newspapers. I'm doing this on my own research, 15 years of research, just like as all the time that I spent on Atlantis with earthquake displacement maps and deluge and theories and stuff like that, all that stuff which is now so well known. I have to give Graham Hancock a lot of credit for taking that idea and making it very popular. We've done this same amount of work on the Bible. And people you're not going to hear this. I'm not going to be telling you again. You're not going to hear this again. If you don't go out and buy this book now, it'll just die. It doesn't matter. I don't really care. I'm 66. I'm enjoying it. I'm in the countryside. I don't care. I've got mountains and hummingbirds and elk, and I'm happy here. Whether people or not read my book, I could care less, really. But if you really want to know what happens in the Bible, here's the deal. I spent a lot of time on this, and mm-hmm. this is very, very different from anything that you're going to get anywhere else. And it's as different as anything that we did with Atlantis. It's as powerful mm-hmm. as what Earth Crust Displacement did in terms of making Antarctica Atlantis. It's the whole thing of the cover-up, the stories of that were lost, the stories that had to be told and whispered under as and became folklore, because if you started to tell the truth, you would be just suppressed. So, you know, it's a very interesting story, and it was a fun thing to figure out. But, you know, that's what I have always been driven by curiosity, and this was a great puzzle. I took this puzzle apart, and I put it back together again at different points, as I did with Atlantis. And it was just a big, big, big toy for me. I spent 17 years in the first one, 15 years on this one. And these are puzzles that I give you different pictures of what the world might be. And, you know,
You think it was just too hot to handle for any publisher to deal with because it kind of tears apart our understanding of religious doctrines that are yes. held in high esteem.
Absolutely.
Interesting. Right. Oh, boy. Well, listen, it's been a wonderful hearing about it. Again, the book, Killing Moses, Solving History's Oldest Mystery, by my guest, they ran, and his wife, Rose Flemoth. I actually saw it on Amazon. It's available on Amazon. I did not digitally available. Is it actually a digital Kindle version too, Ran?
Yeah, it's an ebook and it's a paperback at Amazon.
Okay.
That's where we had to publish.
Okay, excellent.
Bear in mind that I published with major publishers before, and they just wouldn't touch this.
Yeah, interesting.
All my other previous books have been with major publishers. St. Martin's,
okay.
Random House.
I'm going to post it on the international fan page, Earth Ancients, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past. Wow, does this fit that mold perfectly? And I have some photographs that you have sent me, and I will post those with a link to the book and an article that is written directly by you, Ran, and your wife, Rose, that kind of gives an overview of this interesting book, Killing Moses. So
people should consider reading the book, too.
Yeah. We want people to read the book.
You know, I have to say, this generation, all things have to be free. I spent 15 years. I'd like to have some reimbursement for that. it's only $7 to buy the ebook.
Yeah.
I mean, crikey, that's like what is that per year of research?
Yeah, that's nothing. actually, I will. Okay, so what I'll do is, and you're hearing me here on our program, I will post the link to the Amazon page that has the book, has some great reviews, and they can get it that way.
Well, you know, thank you very much, Cliff, for having me. You were taking a chance doing this, too. I hope you don't have any bad repercussions for yourself. I have already had
never. Oh, you're kidding. Interesting.
No.
Wow. I'm sorry to hear that, but you know, Ran, in your work of uncovering anomalous, that may be just the nature of the world. And I'm sorry to hear that, but just what some people deal with. You trigger uncomfortable for those who are following the path of the religion, and so that could be a repercussion. But I think it's a very interesting subject. I'm glad you came on, and the many thousands of people that will be listening and downloading will, I believe, benefit from your research, yours and Rose's research. So thanks for joining me, and much good luck to you. Much good luck. And it'll be on both the Facebook Earth Ancients blog page, which is the group page, and it will be on the international page for everyone to look at. So,
thanks for
joining me.
Okay. Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. So that's been our program, and I want to also let people know that we have a very interesting subject next week. The Gift of Shamanism is the book, and Isaac Berry has done a great deal of research. I typically have issues with people who are taking drugs to shift into other levels of consciousness, but this is more on the level of shamanism, what shamanism is, how it's been around for thousands and thousands of years, and what these shaman do and help in elevating evolution of consciousness. So that's next week. The guest again is Isaac Berry, and this is a brand new book called The Gift of Shamanism. I hope you'll join us for that program. So that's it for today's episode of Earth Ancients. As I remind everybody, always check out the Facebook page, Earth Ancients. There's so much information on there. Our guest today, Rand Altflem, his book will be there with some photographs, and I call them those posts, notes from today's program. So take a look on it, Facebook, Earth Ancients. Have a great day.